Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for August 17th, 2023. Many, many topics to cover tonight. The last 2 weeks, I want to remind you, I was talking about my commentary relative to the recent movie Oppenheimer and all of the stir about that, the atomic bomb, the making of the bomb, and the current situation in the world where the Cold War is still going on, if you haven't noticed. It took a little bit of a hiatus after Reagan, and what Reagan did, if you didn't live through that era, which I did, what Reagan did is he said, we're going to break the Soviet Union. And this is the old Soviet Union. And so what he said is we're going to invest into what they call the Star Wars program, basically a space warfare program. And up until that time, the idea was that there should be a balance of power between Russia and the United States. And this is the banker thing. So listen to my show to understand that concept, where the Rothschild banking empire kept the United States and Russia at each other's throats for 50 years with the idea that that's how they maintain their power. So that I explained that on my radio show the last couple of weeks. The important point that I want to emphasize this week, go back and listen to those two shows on the archives. My webpage, jmccsci.com, has all the archives going back decades, but listen to those two shows. It was August 3rd and August 10th. Listen to those two shows. And this is going on today. This whole issue of, for example, the Biden administration. I don't say Biden because Biden is an old man back in some basement somewhere with a drool bucket. So the people running this country now, let's just put it that way, are now putting sanctions, various types of economic sanctions on China, saying that American companies cannot invest in China. And here's the very simple story here. This is all, you know, the China, 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 and the Russia, Russia, Russia thing. The United States is much better off economically if we include those markets. And so it would be like, let's say a store in a town. Say that store only can sell to people in the town. Okay, now imagine that that store can all of a sudden start selling in other towns. Gee, it would make more money. It would do much better. And what would happen if other competition came in to sell similar products in that town? It would give you basically a world market. People, I'll tell you something. I traveled all over the place. I know people in all these different countries. They want American products. Believe me. They want American products. And they want to know how American products are made. And so, you know, it's a world market. So when you start chopping it up, you start chopping off the head of the goose that lays the golden egg. Okay, so anyway, I just want to mention here, this, I get many, many magazines every day by email, and this story just kind of caught my eye. It's about coal in India, and what's going on in both India and China, they are using record amounts of coal. So the amount of coal in the world is going up, although the United States dropped its consumption of coal in the last number of years by 24%, replacing it with natural gas. But there's not enough natural gas in all of these different countries to replace it. Russia was selling to Europe. They blew up the pipeline. And so it takes a long time to build a pipeline that can transport that amount of natural gas to a faraway place. And so it really, really caused a large problem for the other industries where they're worried about global climate change. And my attitude is we should be just worried about burning all of this stuff, what they call fossil fuels, which is a misnomer, obviously, because coal and oil did not come from fossils. From dinosaur bones. How absolutely absurd. People still repeat that and use the term. But at any rate, the overall world usage of coal has increased. And that's because there's, the Paris Accord, where everybody says, oh, we shouldn't have backed out of the Paris Accord. The Paris Accord was nothing but a manner of taking money from the United States, putting another tax on the United States, and bringing us down to the level of China and India and other third world countries. Because it's been long known that if the United States is powerful, then the one world government will not work. It can't work in an environment where all of the countries are at a certain level. There's a low level, a medium level, and then you have the United States at a high level, economic level. It doesn't work for the New World Order people. So they got to drive down the United States. So everything that's going on today, all of the chaos, has one goal and one goal only, and that is to take the United States down to the level of third world countries. And that's what's going on right now. You got the inmates running the insane asylum, and in a, you could view it in that respect, but the whole purpose is to destroy the United States. Okay, a few quick announcements here. There is a sale on my webpage, on the water filter webpage. And remember, I don't have sponsors. I don't have commercials. The only money I make to support what I'm doing here is when you buy water filter products. So go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, click on the Shop Products button at the top of the page, and there's a sale on the MR5. You can use the coupon code JMCC to get another discount on all the products. So, okay, enough said. The webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. Another thing I rarely mention is I do have a Patreon channel, and the for members, and this is for people that think what I'm doing is really good and they want to donate a little bit. It could be as little as $5 a month, or it could be as much as it goes up to large amounts. But if you like what I do and you want to support a little bit, go to my Patreon channel. Is patreon.com/jmccsci, and that, by the way, is the URL, the short URL that I use on the radio for my main webpage, my traditional webpage, jmccsci.com, and you can buy the grow towers there. There's a link to the Patreon channel there. There's a link to the water filter stuff there. Okay, enough of that. And I'm reminding people too, this show right now airs and re-airs in many venues on podcast platforms, etc. That's great. But I encourage people to get a shortwave radio and listen on shortwave. WWCR, Nashville, Tennessee, tower number 2. I've been at this spot for 23 years, I guess, something like that, and continuing. So I encourage people to get a shortwave radio. Get one that goes down to the lower bands, I'd say down to 3 megahertz range, and hopefully a crank-up type, so if something happens, you don't have to have batteries or rely on batteries. And because someday there might not be internet, and this would be the only way you have of listening to some real news. Okay, I have a lot of other things to talk about here. Oh, my education package is unavailable. This is for K-12 and parents of K-12. My education package for a supplement for science, very important, very extensive, and very inexpensive. I've been looking around at other education packages for kids, and they're very expensive, and they're probably pretty good, but there's nothing for science. And that's what my education package specializes in. Is first educating the parents, and then the parents educate the kids. And that also is on the webpage, jmccsci.com. And just by the way, notice that you get something really valuable if the water filters or the education package or my books, things that you cannot find anyplace else. Okay, this is an important topic. I've covered it before, but there's more and more heat waves going on all over the place. You hear about the fires in Hawaii, people jumping off the island into the ocean because of wildfires. And this not all of this, but a lot of it, because what they're doing is they're saying, oh, everything is due to global climate change. And they're saying it's heating up and it's, here's the reality, however. Earth is self-regulating. So if the temperature increases and the amount of heat content increases, then the water should evaporate, there should be more clouds, and it should cool down. Earth is a self-regulating weather engine, basically. And remember, also, we're coming out of an ice age. We had an ice age here on this planet a number of thousands of years ago, and the glaciers resulting from that ice age are just now finishing melting. When I was a kid, 50 plus years ago, the big glaciers out west were still there. They're pretty much all gone now. And those glaciers were much bigger 100 years earlier, and 100 years before that, they were much bigger. So we're coming out of an ice age, so that's one of the issues with global, just the world getting back to normal after an ice age. But here's the other thing, that what they're doing is controlling low pressure cells. And what that happened, the way it's done is with laser satellites, very easy to do. I was one of the people instrumental in developing this technology to remove hurricanes from harm's way, in other words, to move them offshore. And then the idiots in the military took control of this, and these, by the way, are being controlled by the U.S. military. The insane asylum, like I said at the beginning, the insane asylum, the inmates are running it. But the other part of that is if you're driving hot weather from the equatorial regions up into places like the United States, then you're driving cold air from up north down to the tropics, and in many tropical areas, it's very, very cold. And so it's much colder than normal. Brazil lost its coffee crop. Now, coffee grows in very tropical areas. So Brazil lost its coffee crop to snow. It actually snowed in Brazil, just to give you an idea. So they're driving cold weather down into the tropics and warm weather, and then people go, oh, it's getting much warmer. It must be global warming. It's to convince you, the general public, that there's some kind of global warming issue going on when there really is not. It's being manipulated. Okay, now there's a Comet 12 Pepys-Brooks, that has developed the horns of the bull. Now this is a biblical reference that to these types of comets, where they're talking about a comet that develops a sunward, basically a symmetrical pair of, they look just like horns. That's why they call them the horns of the bull. And this was listed in early August, about a week and a half ago, in some of the space-related journals or on online magazines. I wouldn't really call them journals. And but what's funny is then you have these scientists who are guarding the Holy Grail of astronomy, that comets are somehow dirty snowballs, which they're not. They say, oh, but these are due to volcanoes. Well, nobody has ever seen a volcano on a comet. After all the comets that have been visited, nobody has ever seen a volcano. And even if it were volcanoes, how do you have two volcanoes that are exactly symmetrical relative to the sun? Because these comet nuclei are tumbling. They're not sitting there still. And how would you have two volcanoes that are perfectly symmetrical, going off at exactly the same time, exactly the same amount of ejecta? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. As soon as you peel back the first onion layer of this, it's a volcano baloney, it doesn't make any sense. But that's the garbage science they're pounding off on you, the public. Oh, it's in absolutely insane. And by the way, here are a number of other physical occurrences that happen in the universe where symmetry has to be explained in any theoretical explanation. galactic formation. When you look at galaxies, they are radially symmetrical. High level of symmetry. If you see a star cluster on one side of the nucleus, you find a star cluster on the other side of the nucleus. If you find a void area on one side of the nucleus, you find a void area on the other side of the nucleus, equidistant from the nucleus. This is just something that is reality. And part of my astronomy course that's available on my webpage, it's one of the downloadable DVDs. One of the things I concentrate on is the symmetry in various things, especially galaxies. And it tells you that the standard explanation that somehow two galaxies got near each other and formed the spiral arms and started a gravity wave, that doesn't explain very high level of symmetry. It's just absolutely insane. But people will repeat that. And that's why when you look at the astronomy, astrophysics, space science world, you're not dealing with high intelligence there. You would think, oh, these people are the smartest people on the planet. But really, in my experience, they're some of the dumbest. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to get a PhD in these areas. There's a lot of work, there's a lot of rigorous work. But most of them, here's the key. Here, most of them stop taking real physics. I'm talking about real physics and real mathematics courses. They stop taking them very early in their careers, and then they branch off into some theoretical esoteric topic like black holes or, the Big Bang or microwave background radiation. They branch off into these areas, and they probably really never knew that much real physics. And so they really don't know anything. They don't understand. What I did is I continued to pursue my education in mathematics and physics. I have a double major in my college, mathematics and physics. When I was teaching at the university level, I taught probably all the mathematics courses there were, including engineering and mathematics for physics, plus more esoteric mathematics topics like logic or principles of infinity, the anyway, on and on. But most physicists that are dealing with space science, astronomy, astrophysics, really get buttonholed into these kind of what you call accepted theories, and they never get out. They have to, because of their advisor, they have to kowtow to all of this stuff, and they don't really ever have a brain of their own. Also, the theory of evolution, of biological evolution, there is great symmetry when you look at any animal or a fish or whatever. There's great symmetry in the construction of these animals and people, etc. There's symmetry, and this is not explainable by evolution. If things just happened willy-nilly, random, put this thing over with this thing over there, symmetry would not be an aspect of the final result. So evolution, the concept of evolution, that somehow we developed from the apes and the apes developed from littler species and those littler species developed from other littler species, it's like the chicken and the egg. What came first, the chicken or the egg? What came first, beings or symmetry? Where did this symmetry come out of evolution? And of course, they can't explain it, or they can't explain things like, for example, in the human body, we have a lot of carbon. Okay, and carbon is a very special atom in the human body. The way it constructs with other atoms, it's part of the DNA chain, it's part of the information that's in biological systems. But here's the question: why is the carbon atom that's in a biological system, which is instrumental in that system functioning the way it does, why is that carbon atom different than the carbon atom that's in a diamond, which doesn't do any of those things? That's a pretty difficult question to answer. And so what they say is, oh, well, the carbon is in an organic molecule. Well, the organic molecule definition is based on something that's related to life. So it's a circular reasoning. They're defining one thing and they go around the path and then come back and say, oh, well, that explains this. They're just using terminology, and it doesn't explain why does that carbon atom that's in the person over there, why is that carbon atom acting differently than the carbon atom in a diamond? Another way of looking at it is, why isn't a diamond carbon atom organic? No, in that case, you call it inorganic. The carbon atom, and if you took the carbon atom from the diamond and you put it in place of the carbon atom in the person, and took the carbon atom from the person and put it into the diamond, they would act organically in the person, inorganically in the diamond. So it's the same atom, but they act differently. You know, there's a grand design here, and part of this is where you come up through the different levels of, say, fish and chickens and then monkeys and then people. They all have this symmetrical aspect to them, and that is not explained by evolution. They kind of hand wave over that. When I used to be in a class, and a professor who really wasn't on his toes on a given day, maybe hadn't prepared well, we would, as students, would say, "Hey, well, okay, explain this more. Go into more detail." And sometimes they would do something like we called it hand waving, or the other term was a snow job. In other words, they would say something and then brush over it and go keep on going, because they didn't understand. So we were the teachers were very tough on us when I was in physics in college, etc. But we were pretty tough on the teachers also. We didn't let them come into class unprepared, and they were always very well prepared, might say that. So evolution is another one of those things where symmetry cannot be explained by standard science. Here's another thing, the symmetry in the solar system. If you look at all of the big planets, you go from Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and even little Pluto way out there, all of these planets move in the same direction around the sun. But there's a lot of stuff that does not. And the controlling direction is controlled by the planet Jupiter. Okay, so I'm not going to go into that right now, but what I want to talk about is the moons. I want to talk about the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, for example. Earth, we only have one moon. It's a big one. And it goes around Earth in the same direction as we go around the Sun. But Jupiter has a lot of moons. Not all of them go prograde, in other words, in the same direction as Jupiter and the other planets going around the Sun. They're retrograde, they go in the other direction. So that creates a bit of symmetry, which is not explainable by the standard theory of how solar systems form. And of course, that really disproves that theory, because if there's a rule in mathematics, if there's one exception, then that disproves the theorem or the lemma. The theorem in mathematics can be disproven by one counterexample. So if you go out to the solar system and you say, okay, all of this formed from the swirling dust cloud, and it all formed at one time, and then you find one object that's going in the other direction, you go, well, how did this happen? And the answer is it can't explain it. But if you found one, you might hand wave it off and say, no big deal. But if you find a lot of them, which there are, then all of a sudden you have a problem. You can't explain them with a standard theory, and it's due to symmetry. The standard theory cannot explain symmetry. And I have one other example. One of my favorite examples of symmetry, which nobody could explain, is in the prime numbers. When I was studying prime numbers and I finally cracked the code of the prime numbers and found out they form a beautiful mathematical system all on their own, The one of the properties they have is symmetry. And it's something that no one in the mathematical world in the right mind would have ever imagined. The most they could imagine was that the prime numbers are random. There's no rhyme or reason to them. They just appear here and there willy-nilly, and there's no way to calculate them, no way to predict them. The only way they could find them before is something called a sieve, which a very rudimentary form of net, so to speak, a mathematical net, where you would trap out the non-prime numbers, and the ones that were left over were prime. A very crude way of doing it, or just using brute force calculations. But it turns out that the prime numbers have symmetry. And so there's, and I explain this in my book, I'm not going to go into it here. But when this was published in 2005, my first release to the public, the people just couldn't fathom this, that the prime numbers somehow possess mathematical properties, one of them being symmetry. And just to give you an example of a symmetry set in mathematics, if you start at zero and you go to the right direction on a number line, you would go to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if you went left of zero, you'd go to negative 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the negative direction. That's symmetry. The negative 5 and 5 are symmetrical. They're the equal distance from 0, one in the left direction, one in the right direction. That is symmetry in a number system. But nobody, like I say, nobody in the mathematical world in their right mind would have ever dreamed that the prime numbers exhibit symmetry. So these are all examples of how symmetry can be used to disprove standard concepts in mathematics and in science. Now, this entire discussion on symmetry started because I was talking about Comet 12P Pons Brooks. And that's kind of a mouthful, so I'll explain this. Comets are named after their discoverers, and they typically will have a number indicating the number of the discovery. So you have the number 12, P. Pons, and Brooks. And so these were discoverers of this comet, and it's just another comet in the sky, but it is exhibiting these symmetrical, very symmetrical horns. Now, I've given you a little bit of an idea about symmetry, and this happens in nuclear physics. Great discoveries have been made in, for example, nuclear physics and other types of physics because of the understanding of symmetry. There's things that have to be balanced. If you have something created, for example, the discovery of antiparticles, where you have positively charged particles, for example, the positron versus the electron, its discovery was based on symmetry. Okay, so anyway, back to this comet. Now imagine a comet. Okay, it has activity. They're saying, these so-called experts, which are not experts at all, they're very poorly informed people. The people who are employed, let's say, at NASA, European Space Agency, and work on comets, claim that this is a snowball. And so, how does this snowball magically come out with these perfectly symmetrical horns? And not only perfectly symmetrical, they're pointed directly at the sun. And of course, they don't talk about that. So then this clown, Tony Phillips, comes along and says, oh, it's due to volcanoes. Well, first of all, like I said, nobody's ever seen volcanoes on a comet before. Okay, but let's play devil's advocate. Let's say there could be a volcano on a comet. Okay, now these are coming out at two completely different points from the comet nucleus, according to their theory. But the other issue is that they would have to come out perfectly symmetrical around a line between the nucleus and the sun. The other problem is that the nucleus of this comet is tumbling. And so the volcanoes would not be pointed towards the sun, but only rarely. And so there's another reason why it could not be due to volcanoes. But the symmetry is the game breaker. That's the one that tells you they're completely wrong, that two volcanoes could not be perfectly symmetrical giving out the same, because volcanoes are like pulsating. They give out a blast and then they slow down. And to have them putting out constant ejecta constantly in a perfectly symmetrical pattern with a symmetry line around pointing directly to the sun, it just doesn't wash. The too many factors. And like I say, when you peel back the first layer of onion skin on this, it was volcanoes theory, it doesn't wash. And by the way, this Tony Phillips idiot, he was the guy that I would go to American Geophysical Union meetings, and they always had a publicity room. So you would go to either give your talk or go to the poster session or go to the auditorium where you were presenting or whatever. And then you would leave your information, basically newsworthy information, in the media room. And so all of the presenters would have their information in the media room. Well, I would put mine in there, a stack of paper for the news media to pick up. And Tony would take mine and throw them in the garbage. I found them in the garbage because I'd go there and none of my papers were. I thought, well, I left way more than the news media could pick up. So then I caught Tony throwing my news media information in the garbage. That's your tier two scientist who tries to protect NASA. These people are a piece of work. Anyway, on to the next topic about SpaceX. Okay, switching concepts a little bit here. SpaceX, this is very interesting. SpaceX is doing a lot of launches, a lot. They're putting up their own stuff. They're putting up other countries' stuff. They're putting up private company stuff. They're really doing a lot of launches. And so what's going on is they're starting to launch at night and early in the early morning. And as a result, and this has been going on all along. I mean, it's happened when they, during the Apollo launches and the Gemini launches and back to the earliest days of rocketry when they were going into outer space. And what's going on is they now there's a lot of traffic, rocket traffic going out into outer space. People are taking pictures of it, and what they're seeing is basically the discharge of the ionosphere. Because what do you have? You've got a rocket, and it's got a big long stream tail. And then it's ionized gases that are strung out for miles. The visible part of the rocket plume coming out the rear of the rocket. So this is a many, many miles long, basically, conductor. And so what happens when it starts to get up close to the ionosphere, it discharges the vertical electric field and it causes this, it's like a dayglow type of thing. And it excites the atoms up in the upper atmosphere, and it looks like not like an aurora. It's kind of like a day glow would be a better analogy. And then it stays like that for a while. It's basically creating a hole in the ionosphere, and then it is said that when the sun starts hitting that area of the upper atmosphere, then the ionization from the solar radiation from the light from the sun replenishes those ions and it goes back to normal. But anyway, this would happen during the daytime, etc. But this is why, for example, a couple examples here, people talk about a space elevator. Okay, what they want to do is they want to tether a rope or a cord or a cable to the Earth and then have a big weight out in outer space. This was, I think, this goes back to Arthur C. Clarke having this space elevator, and the idea would be that if you just rode up the elevator, you would get into outer space and you'd be in orbit. Well, isn't that cute? Well, the problem is you would be discharging the vertical electric field from the ionosphere down, creating a tremendous mess, because the discharge of that vertical electric field is what powers hurricanes and tornadoes and cyclonic storms. Okay, not a very good idea. And so another plan of the super intelligent tier two NASA people would be to gather energy from the sun in outer space and then beam it down to Earth, where it could then be transformed into energy and run our economic systems. And it'd be, of course, the sunlight would be a very big source of energy. The only problem is when you discharge, when you send that light beam down to Earth, no matter what form it takes, you're going to be discharging that vertical electric field, and you're going to destroy wherever that station is, receiving station on the Earth, and additionally deplete the ionosphere of its charge. And so this is, by the way, what Tesla was doing with his Colorado Springs and his Wardenclyffe systems, as he was discharging the vertical electric field. And of course they stopped him because he was tapping into what appears to be a near infinite source of energy. And it was at the time when JP Morgan and the boys realized that the future was in selling fossil fuels and oil. And so they didn't want Tesla to succeed. And they notice they did this too. You know, we just saw the movie Oppenheimer, and how what they really did to Oppenheimer was discredit him, put him in a box, get him out of there, because he went to Congress and he said, wait a minute, you know, you had us develop these bombs to end the war in Japan, but now we don't want to see the proliferation of these into a continual thing in the future. So we developed these bombs to stop the war, not to have more wars with these as weapons. So they sidelined Oppenheimer and other people who were against the development of the bomb, calling him a, you know, it's really bizarre, siding with the Nazis or the communists or whatever. And that was during the McCarthy era, where they believed that everybody was a commie and everybody was against the United States. And all Oppenheimer was trying to do was stop them from using these weapons because of the indiscriminate destruction on the populations. And of course, the people in power didn't want anything to do with that. I had my own experience with this when I was moving my electromagnetic propulsion systems through the venture capital groups in Los Angeles in the early 1980s. And I told them, I don't want my technology that I have invented in my theoretical work that I have invented and discovered using these for military purposes. And of course, I was talking to the people who make their money off the military industrial complex. And so, needless to say, we did not see eye to eye on this. But they want scientists and engineers to develop these technologies, but then they want to use it always for warfare because that's where they make their money. It's one of the reasons they don't like Trump, because he funded the military and the industrial complex, the military-industrial complex, for 4 years. He put a lot of money into them, but unless you're shooting bullets and shooting cannons and flying planes and dropping bombs, then all that equipment is just sitting there. It's not making money. So for the military-industrial complex to make money, they need a war, and the magic word has always been Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. If they repeat Russia, they get funding, they get to build more warfare stuff. As long as somewhere, someplace on the planet, right now they're sacrificing the country called Ukraine. Before it was Vietnam, then Laos, then Cambodia, and then before that, South Korea. The Koreas, you know, and to always, always against Russia. And when the money dried up, and the one formula that's always worked is Russia, so they're doing it again. That's what it's all about. You know, and moving money to Ukraine, that money comes flowing back into the pockets of congressmen. You know, most of those people are there to make money and to make money for their buddies. That's what Congress is. It's a money factory. You get the money from loans from the World Bank, you put it into the military-industrial complex, and that's why they have to keep Russia and the United States on par technologically. I talked about this the last 2 weeks on my show. Okay, so back to SpaceX with holes in the ionosphere. This has been going on forever, but now they're starting to notice. But once again, they come along and they say this is due to ion exchange. So you got the goofy guys, the Tony Phillips that want to guard tier two science, putting out garbage science for the public. It's not due to ion exchange. That's something that didn't work in comets. It doesn't work for drilling holes in the ionosphere, and it simply doesn't work in outer space. It doesn't explain. If ion exchange was working, then Earth and all the other planets should have X-ray fields out in front of them, but they don't. And so, the ion exchange simply does not work. When you once again peel back the first layer of onion peel, it doesn't work. Anyway, okay. So we don't really know how long the holes in the ionosphere last when the rockets go through them, because it becomes daytime and you can't see them anymore, and there's no testing being done. Okay, the next story is very interesting, and this is something, I deal with archaeology a lot. And this is something that was discovered maybe a couple decades ago. It was a cave in China. A cave in China where they discovered human teeth. And now, when they dated, they had some bones, some head bones of a human being that they discovered there. And they dated them to about the latest date was about 80,000 years ago, and they could have been as much as 300,000 years ago when these were when they were actually human beings. So the end result here is that there were 47 teeth discovered and a number of head bones from human beings, and the head bones were of a modern man. Like today, this is not, we're not talking Neanderthal man, we're not talking Cro-Magnon man, we're not talking Cro-Magnon man, we're not talking any of these ancient variations of humanoids. We're talking modern man. The teeth were modern man type of teeth. And so what's strange about the teeth, there were 47 of them. They were from 13 different individuals. So some of these teeth belong to the same person, but they're found in a cave. And the way they got into the cave was by a flood washing them into the cave. Now, imagine teeth. Say somebody was, say there was one person living there, or a little group of people. That they were living outside the cave. How did this many teeth get into the cave? Well, if you do the mathematical analysis here, the retro calculations, just like I did with, say, elections, retro calculations, mathematical technique, that would tell you that there had to have been maybe 50,000 to 100,000 people, modern man stature, structure. And then when this wave hits, or this flood, whatever was caused the flood, and typically these floods are tsunamis. And so that means that the people would have been killed, and enough of the people were killed near the cave to where their teeth were washed into this cave. Nothing more, just their teeth. And so this tells you that there must have been, say, upwards of 20,000, maybe 50,000, maybe 100,000 people living in this area of modern man 80,000 years ago. And now, what's interesting is this was in China. So the story that 7,000 years ago, the humanoid species, I hate that word, if you want to call it that, or humanoids, developed in Mesopotamia, coming out of Africa allegedly, and then the races of modern man, the Europeans, the Caucasians, the Orientals, the Mongolians, the Chinese, then the supposedly a number of thousand years ago they migrated across the Bering Strait and then populated the Western Hemisphere, became populated in Peru and in Mexico, the American Southwest, North America. That story, is so bogus, it's so ridiculous that somehow the pygmies of Africa and the tall black people in Africa and then the Peruvian, little short Peruvian people or the Mayans, that all of these people somehow developed out of this one group of people in Mesopotamia 7,000 years ago, that the Egyptian cultures came and went. And, you know, just absolute nonsense. But these discoveries, and I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the footprints that were discovered in New Mexico alongside of mastodons, these are human footprints, would look like your footprint today in rock that was solidified right alongside mastodons, woolly mammoths, giant sloth, and what they call megafauna, animals, large animals that lived during the pre-Holocene period. And there's footprints of people right there next to them, walking around. And so, you know, here we have archaeologists who are still relying on these bogus stories that man is only a few thousand years old and somehow in that period of time evolved into modern man. Just bogus. And but here's the thing. We know that these vast civilizations of people met their demise by large passing comets. And one of the things that's one of the effects of the large passing comet is tsunamis. And so when that big wave rolls in, and these are not your average tsunami like Fukushima. We're talking a 1,000-foot wave kind of tsunami, where they come in, they destroy everything, leave a few teeth from a few of these people that, you know, met their demise in this comet passing event. By the way, my book, the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, my book, part of the middle section of that book goes through what it would be like if a large comet came by Earth, what would be the effects? And one of them is talks about the tsunamis and the great destruction and how it cleans everything. So if one hit, let's say, New York City, New Jersey area, a large, it would just wipe it clean. There wouldn't be a whole lot left. And then maybe someplace in Pennsylvania, there might be a cave where some people's teeth or bracelets or other jewelry might be found. There are cases of that in coal where they find a human bracelet just in the middle of the coal bed. What are coal beds? They are, when the tsunami comes in, it piles up the vegetation, piles it up on the side of a mountain or in a valley, and it, over time, the compresses, all the water is compressed out of there, and you're left with coal, basically the carbon part of the plant material, and that's coal. So at any rate, this article I thought was very interesting in that it also conclusively proves that on this planet, 80,000 to 300,000 years ago, there were people just like you and me, walking around, living, doing things, building cities. And the reason that there is not a lot left, for example, we don't know how the people who built the pyramids, and it wasn't the pharaohs, that's for sure. Whoever built the pyramids in Egypt with the big blocks and millions of big blocks, no, that was not the pharaohs. It was somebody else. But there's no record of them building them or the equipment or the technology that they used. So how did they do that? We still don't know. We just have no idea. But they were, their civilizations, their anything that was there was completely washed away. The only thing left is the pyramid itself, because, you know, it was so big and heavy, it probably met with a certain amount of damage. But who built them? We don't know. But the point is that we're realizing that, you know, upon looking for techniques and how they built the pyramids or cut the blocks or the great, all of the architecture that's there, how did they do that? We don't know because all of those civilizations, what was there was completely washed away by these giant tsunamis. And all we find now and then is a small remnant of that, not enough to put together the many pieces of the puzzle. Okay, on to the next topic here. Voyager 2 lost communication with Earth finally. This is one of the most amazing engineering stories of modern time. Now, when I was at Cornell in 1979 to 81, I was on the faculty there. I was doing my science work. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft were going by Jupiter and Saturn and the other planets. And that's what they were designed for. So they did their job. And then once they continued out into the solar system, they were still operational. But imagine that was how many decades ago. So these spacecraft, and now imagine the transmitter on these spacecraft was little. They don't have solar panels because their work, they're out beyond Jupiter, Saturn. There's really no solar light at all. So solar panels would be useless. So their battery was a nuclear powered battery. And the transmission package, the telecommunications package to receive and send information on the Voyager 2 was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. Now, can you imagine being in communication with a spacecraft and even knowing where it's at and being able to communicate with it from Earth with radio signaling and its radio signaling back data continually to Earth? Over a period of decades, and finally, this last week, if we finally lost communication with it. It had already passed out of the solar system, the extent to which the sun puts out solar, the solar wind, the charged particles from the sun. It got beyond that in what they call the bow shock, in other words, where that the force from that wind terminates in that. The galactic wind, there's a wind in the galaxy that comes from a different direction. They were actually out beyond that bow shock into the galactic wind when this spacecraft lost communication. Absolutely phenomenal. And once again, this is the design, this is the working of engineers. The engineers that work for these companies that build these spacecraft, absolutely phenomenal. A lot of this is subcontracted out from NASA to other corporations, but the engineers that work there, they are the unsung heroes of the space program. People that, and I know a goodly number of them personally, and they're just regular people. If you saw them walking down the street, you wouldn't think that guy there is a rocket scientist. They're just normal everyday people, but very good at what they do. So, bon voyage to Voyager, I guess. Voyager 2 losing communication this past week. And I've talked also about how do you communicate with something that's out there that far. And what they have is they have oscillators, Marconi oscillators. A Marconi oscillator is an electrical circuit that's very highly tuned to a given frequency. And then the Earth-based transmission and receiver is tuned to that same frequency with a very narrow band filter that allows that frequency and only that frequency through. And so it doesn't have a lot of competition. It's like in this filtering system of radio transmission, there's only that frequency that they're using. And so it's like all the other frequencies are blocked out by these narrow band filters. So that's how they do this. And by the way, I've told this story in my, especially my 2022 year-long dialogue about my discoveries. I talk about how the Voyager 2 redshifted when it got to Jupiter, and it had an even bigger redshift when it got to Saturn. I'm not going to go through that again right now. But that was due to the induced electric dipole redshift of Jupiter and Saturn, which are small stars. They have their own capacitor. They have their own fusion-based proton wind capacitor. Okay, well, I've covered quite a few of these topics. I have about a page and a half more of these very interesting topics dealing with archaeology, and I don't have enough time to talk about the X-RISM spacecraft. I'll talk about that next week. A new X-ray spectrum telescope that is going up. It's a NASA Japan collaborative work. So I'll talk about that. Let me just remind you to go to my webpage. If you want to support me on my Patreon channel, go to patreon.com/JMCCSCI, JMCCSCI on Patreon. And that's the same letter designation as the URL for my main webpage, JMCCSCI.com. And from there, you can get to the water filter page, to the Patreon page, to the archives of my radio show, to the information on the wing generator, the private space program, all kinds of things there that are available information. So the web page jmccsci.com. And I just want to remind you to become water independent. And this is something I feel very strongly about. I have the best water filters on the planet. They are the direct web page is jmccwaterfilters.com. But like I say, you can get there from the jmccsci.com webpage. Also, the grow towers are there. And the MR5, the whole house water filter, is right now on sale. A tremendous discount. Actually, about $600 off list price for what I call the best deal. The best deal is the MR5 water filter, whole house water filter, stainless steel, beautiful construction. It's so nice you could put it in the middle of your, Christmas or Thanksgiving dinner table, and it would be a centerpiece. That's how finely crafted these are. But stainless steel construction. Then you get the ultraviolet sterilizer and an extra pack of filter elements, and normally $23.99. And on sale for 17, I think it's 1780, a real big deduction in the price there. So once again, go to the webpage jmccsci.com or directly to the water filter page jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.